It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up next, Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin have said that they plan to take up right-to-work legislation, which would put restrictions on private unions this upcoming legislative session. First, on Monday, the world's first e-resident got his ID card. In a ceremony in the country's capital, the president of Estonia declared a British journalist, Edward Lucas, the first ever e-resident of the world. Estonia, which is a tiny country of 1.3 million people, hopes many more will follow that lead. In fact, they've set an ambitious goal of adding millions of people and tens of thousands of companies to their list of e-residents. They're hoping people will be attracted by the ease of doing business with this tiny, tech-savvy country as a gateway to the European Union. Joining us now is Edward Lucas. He's a senior editor at The Economist, a senior fellow and contributing editor at the Center for European Policy Analysis, and the world's first e-resident. He joins us now from London. Edward, welcome to Central Time.
Nice to be with you, Veronica.
Well, on Monday, you became the world's first e-resident. Now, this is clearly a pretty new thing. How would you describe exactly what an e-residency is?
Well, an e-resident is someone who doesn't live in Estonia but has the ability to do the things on the internet that Estonians take for granted but everybody else in the world finds very difficult. And that's chiefly, if you remember the famous New Yorker cartoon, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. And Estonians can prove they're not dogs, and they can prove that, and they can see that other people aren't. You can send an authenticated email, and it really does come from the person who's sending it. You can sign something with a digital signature, and that's as good as a physical signature on a bit of paper. And you never have to give the same information twice. Once you've got that card in your hand and the PIN number that goes with it, you are you on the internet. So it really does, for our travels on the internet, what American Express did for our international travels a few decades ago. Just one bit of plastic in your pocket, you can go anywhere and do everything. And I thought that was tremendously exciting, and I was really honored to be given number 00001.
And have you put it to use already?
Indeed, I have, actually. The first thing I did was for my travel expenses to Estonia, because the Estonian government paid for me to go, and they needed my signature on a bit of paper to show that I was happy with that. And so they sent me a Word document, which was signed by them, and I got it up on the screen, and I put my card in my card reader and opened the little signing app and typed in a PIN number, and that was as good as if I'd signed it with pen and ink and put it in the post to them.
Do you think that the applications of this right now are primarily financial, or is there more to it?
I think there's several elements to it. One is that you have hundreds of millions of people around the world who would love to do business in the European Union. European Union is the world's biggest single market, 500 million consumers, a $20 trillion economy. And if you're in India or the United States or wherever, you might want to set up a business in the European Union. At the moment, to do that, you have to go there, physically go there, and fill in lots of forms and, you know, do it the old-fashioned way. But with this e-residency card, once you've got it, and you can get it from the Estonian consulate or embassy as of next year, then you can virtually go to Estonia on the internet, and you can open a company, open a bank account, and then you're in. You're doing business in the European Union. So that's one very big thing. And I think from the Estonian point of view, it's very important because they are a small country, perhaps not tiny, as you said, because, you know, tiny is relative, but 1.3 million people. And they're pretty worried living right next door to Russia. And this is a way for them to build up a digital diaspora of people who will obviously do business in Estonia, and that's all good, but also it creates a kind of wider community of people who think well of the country and care about its security. So it's a bit of an insurance policy for them as well.
And for people who don't want to open a business, who don't necessarily want to bank in Estonia, do you see other more practical applications coming down the pike, or at least, you know, things that are less specialized?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for example, if you have a business and you're worried about these spam or these spear phishing emails where you get an email that seems to be from the chief executive saying, please authorize so-and-so. And this is a real problem in cybercrime at the moment, that you can't tell when you get an email, did it really come from this person or did it just come from someone who's hacked into that person's email account? And once you've got this e-citizenship, you can send an email. It's absolutely clear. It's rock solid, crystal clear that email came from the person. So I can imagine companies saying, right, we're going to get 500 of these things and everybody is going to use them. If you send an email within the company, you sign it because we want to know that these emails come from the people who came to send them. So I can see, I'm just at this very basic level, everything we do on the internet suffers from this kind of quasi-anonymity where you never really know what you're dealing with. And you have all this faffing around with typing the first and third digits of your memorable number and then the fourth and fifth letters of your memorable word. And, you know, we're extremely inadequate and badly secured identification systems on the internet, which basically don't work and are very badly administered. And this having this bit of plastic in your pocket and the PIN code in your head, that short circuits all that, gives you something much better.
If you're finding this so useful, you know, why shouldn't England, for instance, where you're from, where you are a citizen, not an e-citizen, an actual, terrestrial citizen, I guess, to use the word, why won't they just adopt these things, and why shouldn't each country just do this for their own citizens?
Well, I mean, you're an American. I would love you to just speculate on the idea of the American government saying we are going to issue digital ID cards to all American citizens. I think you might find that was not seen as something that every American really wanted. The great thing about the Estonian system is it's an opt-in, and you can, if you like it, you can do it, and you get all the extra convenience. Again, it's a bit like credit cards. If you like credit cards, you can use them. If you don't like them, you can always pay cash, and it's a bit more inconvenient. And I think other countries will come up with similar systems. So Singapore, for example, which is another very well-run country, although perhaps not quite as democratic as Estonia, they're thinking of opening an e-citizenship or e-residency program for people in East Asia. And I think, it rather like credit cards, you'll have lots of competing offers with different degrees of convenience and security. And that's great. I love the idea that countries are competing to offer themselves as platforms for people in other countries. But what's important about Estonia is they've been doing this for 12 years. They have the best e-government program in the world. You file your taxes in Estonia, and literally it takes you 30 minutes to do it, sometimes even less, and you get your tax refund the same day. So they've kind of proved how to do this stuff in a way that most other countries haven't.
Now, the e-residency program, it seems to want to create a high-tech, borderless digital world. Do you see this as being something that's practical, given the realities of the physical world, things like bureaucracy and red tape, which are part of our daily lives?
Well, they don't need to be. And I think, I mean, the stuff we really enjoy, which is hanging out with friends and, you know, doing all the stuff that actually makes life worth living, is always been, the time we have for that is being bitten into because we spend so much time on this pointless bureaucratic stuff. And what I notice in Estonia is that people actually have more time to do stuff that's fun because they spend such a minimal amount of time interacting with government. It all happens very, very quickly. For example, you never have to give the same information twice by law. Once you've given some information to the government, it's the government's job to shuffle that around and not your job to give it again. So you don't have all that stuff of endlessly putting in your date of birth and your social security number and trying to prove who you are. So I like the idea of this kind of frictionless, flat world where we can get on with stuff that we actually want to do and don't have to spend a lot of time getting around the fundamental inadequacies of the way the internet was designed. Because remember, the internet wasn't designed to be the central nervous system of modern civilization. The internet was designed as a mechanism for academic collaboration. It just kind of accidentally barnacled and morphed into being so important. But there are some fundamental flaws of the way the internet was designed. And this, I think, is addressing one of the biggest of those flaws.
Do you see this as something that could potentially chip away at the relevancy of actual nation states?
Well, I think it depends what you're doing in life. If you don't want to travel abroad, then you don't really need a passport. And obviously America is a very big country and many Americans don't have passports. And why should they need them? There's plenty to see in America. In small countries, people tend to want to travel, so then your national ID matters more. Driving licenses, again, if you drive in another country, you may need to get some kind of international driving license or something that will be recognized there, particularly if you do it for a certain amount of time. And so we're quite used to managing these sort of different privileges and identities as we travel between countries. But the thing about the internet is it all works so quickly. So I might want to be doing business in Estonia, then I might sign a document with a company in Ireland, and then I might want to do something in Japan or Singapore or wherever. And if I've got this very strong, cryptographically secure identity, I don't need to go to a notary and show my passport and get a signature and a photocopy and a stamp on the photocopy and then FedEx it to the other side of the world. I can say, well, do you take digital signatures? Great. I've got a smart card reader here. I'll give you a digital signature right now. And they will recognize that digital signature. So it acts kind of accelerant to all the stuff we need to do on the internet.
So do you think if you've got this e-residency with Estonia, would you theoretically need one or benefit from having one in other countries too?
Well, I think it depends what you want to do. And it's really a question of who do you trust. And I trust the Estonians much more than I trust my government, because the British government has a lamentable record of losing its citizens' data, and where our bureaucrats are constantly leaving CDs and thumb drives on buses and trains and in the street. And I really feel nervous about the British government having access to my personal data. I feel quite comfortable about the Estonian government having access to some sort of register of documents I've signed and issuing these cryptographical certificates, because they've proved themselves pretty good at it. They haven't been hacked. There's never been any serious problems there. But maybe someone else will come along and say, well, look, we do it even better. Maybe the Norwegians would say, for example, well, here's a cryptographically secure digital ID, but guess what? We've put a photo on it. So now you can use this not just as a digital ID, but a real-world ID. You can board a plane showing this. Well, that would be a very attractive offer. Then I might consider something else. But that's the great thing about competition. It stimulates innovation and choice, and it puts us as the consumers in the driving seat, which is where we really haven't been so far on the internet. We've been pushed around by the providers on the internet, trying to make us fit into their way of doing things. And it just hasn't worked very well. I'm very glad there's an alternative.
And Edward, just briefly, let's say I want to be an e-resident of Estonia. What do I have to do?
Wait, because, well, first of all, go to Estonia, because if you go right now, you can get one. It's in what they call beta, but that will last for another few months. And when they've ironed out all the kinks and got everything absolutely perfect, then it's going to be available from any Estonian diplomatic mission, so embassy, consulate, something like that. You turn up, do a biometric check, show your existing passport, go through the hoops so they can be really sure that you're you, and then you get a thing in your pocket. It's like a credit card, bit of paper with your PIN numbers, and off you go.
Edward, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure, Veronica.
We've been speaking with Edward Lucas, senior editor at The Economist, senior fellow and contributing editor at the Center for European Policy Analysis, and the world's first e-resident. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk to the creator of a project that's been collecting anonymous secrets from around the world for the last decade. First, this morning, Wisconsin Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald told conservative talk radio host Charlie Sykes that he plans to take up so-called right-to-work legislation at the beginning of the coming legislative session, which ends in a few weeks. The legislation would restrict unions at private companies from requiring employees to pay dues. The announcement is a turn for Republicans in the legislature, who've mostly said right-to-work legislation wasn't a priority in the past and largely avoided conversation about it during the elections. Yesterday, Governor Walker told reporters he hoped lawmakers would focus on his agenda and not on taking up right-to-work legislation. In related news this past Monday, a new organization called Right to Work Wisconsin launched in the state. Here to talk with us about the proposal and the politics behind it is Jason Stein. He's a state government reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and co-author of the book More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions and the Fight for Wisconsin. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Governor Walker said yesterday that he hoped the legislature would not take up a right-to-work bill this session. And this morning, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said that they would take it up. So are the Senate and the governor at odds over this?
I suppose that they are. I think it's as simple as the majority leader is recognizing, kind of stating the obvious, if you will, that with the more conservative caucus that he now has, the issue is going to come up. So rather than wait for that to happen, he is going out to meet it head on.
And this seems to be a bit of a shift for the legislature in terms of what they've said in the past. So based on what lawmakers have said about right to work so far, was this a surprise?
Legislative leaders, the legislative leaders for the Republicans have said that right to work is not a priority for them, even though some of them, like the Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, have been longtime supporters of right to work. I think the surprise here, to the extent that there is a surprise, the surprise here is that the Assembly and Senate Republicans both added to their majorities in a significant way in last month's elections. So suddenly, both in both houses, Republicans have this commanding control of the body. And when one party gets control of everything to that degree, and obviously, you know, the governor is in the executive mansion, when one party gets control of government to that degree, they start thinking about big things. They start thinking about what are the things we've always wanted to do, and this is on that list.
What do we know so far about Governor Walker's record with Right to Work in the past?
Well, we know that the last time that the bill was, an actual bill was introduced in Wisconsin's legislature, all the way back in the 90s, he was on that bill. So he's never said since then that he wouldn't, you know, that he would veto the bill or that he doesn't support the concept. What he has said time and time again in recent years very consistently is that he doesn't think it's a priority. He doesn't think it's a priority for reasons like he doesn't feel that it's putting the state at a competitive disadvantage not to have it. He's saying that he is concerned that it could bring back political turbulence and uncertainty that would affect hiring decisions by business owners. So he's given a lot of pragmatic reasons why he doesn't want to pursue it, but he's never said he wouldn't sign it.
And in terms of the conservative argument for passing Right to Work in Wisconsin, how is that being articulated right now?
Well, I'm going to hesitate a little bit in weighing in on how it's being articulated because I don't think it's being articulated in a statewide way very strongly or very articulately yet. It certainly came up in certain Republican primaries. Van Wangard, Senator-elect Van Wangard down in Racine, was involved in a very nasty Republican primary election in which another candidate tried to run to the right of him. And in that race, you know, he said that he would support Right to Work legislation. So there's that. It certainly did come up in primary races where it got, you know, some attention. You know, in terms of what the argument is that the state's economy, this is from supporters of this legislation, these restrictions on unions, they're saying that the economy would run better if we had it. Obviously, the opponents of the proposal, the idea, say exactly the opposite.
Now, you've reported that there are some private sector unions that generally support the GOP, like the International Union of Operating Engineers. How is that being considered in the decision to take up this legislation?
Well, now, that's a very interesting wrinkle. There are not many, but a few private sector unions, like the Operating Engineers would be the prime example, that have supported Republicans, particularly Governor Walker. The Operating Engineers, I believe, endorsed him three times. They certainly have backed him in any case, you know, strongly in recent years. So that has been something that the governor has talked about, private sector unions as being his partner in economic development. Fitzgerald today talked about exempting the Operating Engineers and some trade unions from restrictions, saying that, well, we could look at that. If Wisconsin did that, we'd be the first state in the nation to actually do that. There's 24 states that have put these sorts of restrictions on unions and on employers, too, because this is about what kind of contracts employers and unions can sign. And we'd be the first state that would say we're going to do it to some private sector unions, but not others.
And you quote someone in your piece who thinks that could represent a legal hurdle. So I guess it'll be interesting to see how that could play out.
Well, right. Whenever the government says to you or me, you can do this, but you can't do that. And then they say to somebody else, you can do both. There's always a question about whether there's a rational basis for treating us differently from other people. And that was in the many, many lawsuits that were filed over Act 10, which is the equivalent of this legislation for public sector unions. This is the legislation that Walker and the Republican lawmakers passed in 2011. In all the litigation over that law, that was at the heart of it. Are you treating people equally? Do you have a reasonable basis for treating some unions differently? Because remember, police got exempted last time around.
And we leave it there for now. We'll come back and continue our conversation with Jason Stein, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel state government reporter and the co-author of More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions and the Fight for Wisconsin. This morning, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said he plans to take up right-to-work legislation in the Senate within weeks. And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think about this legislation as it stands, perhaps going forward, preventing private sector unions from requiring dues from employees? Act 10 restricted public unions and led to big protests. Do you see this doing the same? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. We're back with Jason Stein, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel state government reporter and co-author of More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions and a Fight for Wisconsin. This morning, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said he plans to take up right-to-work legislation in the Senate within weeks. And we'd like to hear from you on this. What do you think about legislation preventing private sector unions from requiring dues from employees? Now, when Act 10 was passed, restricting public unions in the state, it led to some big protests that lasted for weeks. Do you think the same thing could happen this time around, or do you think that this is not the volatile issue that it once was? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Mark with us in Rosendale. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I am sure that the unions are looking at this as further weakening the unions. I have worked in union shops and I've worked in non-union shops, and I think this should be an opportunity for them to sell their product and tell everyone what a great product they have and voluntarily get people to pay the dues and not force them to pay the dues. I see it as a good thing for the unions and for the non-union.
Okay, well, thank you, Mark. And Jason, do you see that as being something that could emerge, unions sharpening their message and actually trying to bring people in under their own volition?
Sure. That's exactly what they try and do. They try and sharpen their message and get better at recruiting people. And they wouldn't recruit as many people as they have now, and they'd get weaker.
And how do you see this progressing now? We've seen Senate Majority Leader saying he plans to take this up within weeks. Do you see it being fast-tracked, essentially?
Sure.
And how would that proceed?
If it happens, it'll be fast-tracked, absolutely.
All right, we're going to go to our callers again. Susan joins us next in Lake Geneva. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I'm from Oklahoma originally, and it's a right-to-work state. And what that means is that unions are not allowed. They're not welcome there. And right to work means that you can be fired at any time for any reason. And I think it's terrible. I think that it's just another way of getting rid of the unions. And people do not understand how hard it is if you don't have union representation. And so what if they have to pay dues? Big deal. You get a lot for your money. That's what I think anyway. Thank you for listening to me.
Okay, thank you so much for your call, Susan. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Jason, Susan was not a fan of the right-to-work legislation in her state. Do you see this as being pretty contentious as it moves forward?
Absolutely.
You've written this book, co-authored the book about the unions and the fight for Wisconsin, the protest. Do you see this as having that much volatility?
I would be surprised if that kind of lightning was captured in a bottle again. I mean, I think this will play out differently. Because there are so many public sector employees in and around Madison, that issue was very visible here. This issue could be very visible in other parts of the state. You know, I mean, there are people that there, first of all, you know, union workers in the private sector are a pronounced minority. But that being said, they work in places like the Fox Valley. They work at companies like Mercury Marine, Harley Davidson, people that build ships up in Marinette, Wisconsin on the Great Lakes. It's a different set of people who are affected by this legislation, and, you know, it's a different geography. So it won't play out the same way as Act 10 played out. It will certainly be controversial. We'll see how much of a fight over it there is if it goes forward.
We'll go back to our callers now. Joan is with us next in Eau Claire. Hi, Joan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. When you look at right-to-work states, do a little research, what you'll find is that within the right-to-work states, the average incomes are quite low, and the average property value is quite low. So there are a few anomalies across the U.S., but that's generally true. And I think that a lot of people don't realize also that without what we've had with union representation and with union members who have fought for these rights, people wouldn't have a five-day work week. People would not have an eight-hour work day. There would be no maternity leave. There would be no paid sick leave. There would be no paid vacation. Anyway, that's my comment, and thank you again.
All right. Thank you, Joan. And Jason?
Well, I don't want to get in a situation where I'm commenting on people's feelings. They're going to have strong feelings on both sides of the issue. On the subject of both the history of labor law in the United States and the economics of states that do and don't have right to work, I'm not qualified yet to give your listeners more data. But when I am, I will.
Joan, thanks a lot for the call. And Jason, Governor Walker's been pretty open in his interest in running for president. Do you think right-to-work legislation passage in Wisconsin would have any impact on his national image?
It would. I mean, it would be mixed. In a Republican primary, having, you know, a fight in which you, take on enemies of the right and prevail is helpful. On the other hand, in a general election, maybe it's not. Also, the optics of, again, having a state divided, again, maybe not what you want. It's difficult to say how it plays out in a potential national election, but clearly, the governor is saying publicly again and again that he doesn't want to go there. So he doesn't appear to see it as a great political benefit.
And just briefly, I know you're getting up to speed as this issue is still new in Wisconsin, but do you have any idea about how right to work polls with people in Wisconsin?
Let me get back to you on that. On an issue like this, the language of the polling question can give you different results. In the old Act 10 fight, do you talk about giving workers a choice and limiting unions' power? Do you talk about taking away workers' rights? I mean, this is language that both sides in that fight used.
Sorry. We'll leave it there. Jason, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking to Jason Stein, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel state government reporter. This morning, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said he plans to take up right-to-work legislation in the Senate within weeks. And you can continue this conversation on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we talked to a New York Times reporter about the wave of protests set off by a New York grand jury decision not to indict a white police officer whose chokehold on a black unarmed man caused his death. First, we're learning about the world of PostSecret. It's a project started 10 years ago when a man asked people to anonymously mail their secrets to him on postcards. A decade later, he has so many postcards, he had to build an extra room on his house. He's held PostSecret events, given lectures at universities, and written 6 books. Frank Warren joins us now. He's the creator of PostSecret and the author of several books, including the latest, The World of PostSecret. You can find out more about the project at postsecret.com. Frank, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
Well, why do you think it's so important for us to share our secrets, get them out, and share them with the world?
Well, for 10 years, strangers from all over have been mailing me their secrets on postcards, and I've learned a few things through the projects, but there's certainly a lot more mysteries out there. I think one of the things I've learned is that it's healthy to share more secrets with the people we trust than we feel comfortable with, but maybe it's always important to keep some of those secrets private, too.
How can you tell which ones should be shared and which ones should be kept?
Oh, I think that's the crux of our identity as human beings and who we trust and who we want to build those relationships with. I think that's kind of a question we face every day, is what to reveal and what we can conceal. I like to imagine that each of us has this box that we keep our secrets in, and we make a choice every day if we should bury it down deep inside us like a coffin and forget about it, or bring it out, open it, and share it with the people we trust and share our secrets like gifts.
Some of the secrets in the book have changed lives. Some of them are very painful. I wonder if you have a sense, having done this project for so long, how the telling of these secrets affects people.
Well, I'll give you an example from last night. I was speaking at a bookstore here in Arizona, and at the end of PostSecret events, I invite audience members to share their secrets live, not anonymously, but in front of everybody else there. And this woman stood up, and she said, "I'm 65 years old, and I've been losing my hearing, and it's really frustrating because my friends think I'm losing interest in them, but that's not true." And she sat back down. Well, at the signing afterwards, she came up to me, and she said she'd purchased 2 tickets for the event, and she was there by herself. So she gave her other ticket to somebody who came in and sat with her the whole time. And she said after the event, the person she invited in had heard her secret, and it turned out that she was a specialist in hearing. And she wrote down her name and address and invited the woman to contact her. So in some ways, sharing the secret can lead to a sense of healing, I think.
Oh, that's incredible. And I know that's not the only story like that that's come out of the PostSecret project. Now, this is the 6th book, maybe the last book. It's the first one in a while. How has this community evolved over the course of the years when you first started it with your simple send a postcard thing?
When I started it, it almost felt like a prank, this idea inviting strangers to write down a secret, decorate the card, and mail it to my home. But as they started arriving, I would scan them, post them on the web, and soon people were responding to these secrets in a way that I found really surprising, in kind of expressing compassion, understanding, the idea of me too, no one's alone with their secret. And soon this community built up around the project, the idea of how sharing the secret turned out to be this first step, and how in some ways, if we keep those secrets inside, they're like walls. But if we can find a way to let them go, they become bridges that connect us to others in really surprising ways. With the first book, I got this email I can still recall from a girl, and she said, "Frank, when I found out about your project, I wanted to write down all my secrets on postcards and mail them to you. And I wrote them all down, but instead of mailing them to you, I decided to leave them on the pillow of my boyfriend in the morning before I went off to work, and I did." And she said, later that morning, he called me at work and asked me to marry him, and I said, yes.
Wow. So that's an example where telling those you trust is the right way to go.
Yeah, the stories certainly don't always work out that way, but I think part of being a human and expressing ourselves is to take those risks, and if we don't, maybe that regret is even larger.
Some people, it's evident reading this book, some people don't have anybody that they feel that they can tell. They feel alone. And I was struck reading these secrets how it did seem as though people felt that, especially when there was some interaction, like with
the Post Secret app, which was that older version is now gone, but those people really felt like they were with a community who was supporting them.
Yeah, there were millions, actually, of secrets shared using the Post Secret app, taking a picture with the camera, typing a text secret, and sharing it out with the world and responding to it. And I'll give you an example of how community built up around that, even anonymously, these amazing acts of kindness. A young man using his smartphone took a picture out his bedroom window. I think it was his bedroom window. He said, "I've just been diagnosed with a terminal illness, and I wanted to see the world, but now I'll never get the chance." And he sent that out to the world, and within a week, over 700 strangers using the app took photos of attractions and monuments and sites near them and sent them all to this young man. So he virtually did get a chance to see the world through the kindness of strangers he'll never get a chance to thank.
Right, I saw that one. That one was incredibly powerful to read and emotional to read. I mean, he got pictures from New Zealand and Bangkok, and a tired mother just sent her view with her child. It was an amazing glimpse of the community that was there.
Yeah, and sometimes, too, these secrets can remind us of the stories of heroism and frailty playing out in the lives of people all around us, the people we walk by on the sidewalk, we see in the cars next to us on our commute. There was one secret in the app. It said, I was babysitting at a neighbor's house, and I realized that I was the birth mother of the adopted daughter that I was babysitting, and I realized it when I saw that the picture on their fireplace of their daughter was the one I sent to them.
Oh, wow. Is it sometimes frustrating for you to get these things, which are incredible and monumental pieces of information, because these are people's darkest, most intimate secrets, but you don't often get to know the ending?
Yeah, it's kind of like a mystery novel. These secrets are put on postcards, which are very limited. It's a limited amount of space to express yourself on. It's almost like this graphic haiku. And because the secrets are so concise, it kind of invites you to draw upon your own experiences and emotions to complete the secret in a way that makes sense to you and kind of invites you into the story. So I think, on the one hand, it is frustrating not knowing the rest of the story, but on the other hand, it allows you to feel a personal connection to this person you'll never have a chance to meet. And really, for me, the most extraordinary part of the project is when you're paging through a Post Secret book or visiting the Post Secret website, and you come across a secret written in somebody else's handwriting that articulates a burden or a fear or a passion that you're carrying in your heart at that moment better than you could even express it yourself.
And then I guess you don't feel so alone.
And then you don't feel so alone, or at least maybe you recognize the illusion that we are alone when the truth is we're not. There's this network of connections between us beneath the surface that's real and true and there all the time. We just can't see it. But through these secrets, I think those discoveries can be made.
Now, we were talking about the Post Secret app from a while back. You took it down eventually because there was some bullies, some very persistent people who were kind of ruining things for the community. But you have a new app out. What is going to happen with the new app?
With the new app, we're introducing some of the best Post Secret app secrets and the stories and postcards, and we take people on a behind-the-scenes tour of the project over the 10-year history of Post Secret. So it just gives us a chance to kind of pull back the veil even further and invite people into the project. I've always felt that, you know, this project being about secrets, it's really important that I be as transparent as possible, and so that's why I always invite people to mail their postcards to my home, not a P.O. box. And with the Post Secret app, we invite people actually into my home to have this tour of the project. And so they can see not just the individual postcards from the project, but the entire pyramid of over a million postcards taller than me. We had to build another room onto our house just to maintain
wow.
This ton of secrets on postcards.
Right, and you've even got a section in your book devoted to your mail carrier, one of them, anyway, whose life was changed, too, by being the person who delivered the mail to your house.
I was so lucky to have Kathy as that first mail carrier, and there are so many interesting stories that she shared with me, and I'm so happy I could include them in the book. I'll just tell you one. Early on in the project, I had no idea if Kathy knew why she was delivering so many postcards into my overstuffed mailbox. And so I asked her if she had a favorite postcard, if she knew about the project. And to my surprise, she said she did. She had a favorite postcard she had delivered to my mailbox. And she told me it was one that said, "I used to work at the post office, and we used to read everybody's postcards. Are you doing that?" Yeah, I think we know that she is now.
I've always wondered that. Well, speaking of things that might surprise us, there's some controversial postcards that you've gotten. You write about how you've been approached by the police and other investigators before because of information revealed. Some of them have been serious because they could involve crimes. Some of them just rile people up. I remember reading one about someone who revealed on a postcard that they made their cat drink bleach so that they could go see the cute vet. What happened with that one?
Probably the postcard that generated the most feedback from viewers, emails and letters and responses. And it can be surprising which secrets provoke the most response. You would think it might be a secret about child abuse or a crime. But no, the ones about pets generate the most reaction. And there are some secrets that I'm kind of judicious about how I share. I received one postcard. It had a portrait of a family on it, and the secret written across the front said, "My brother doesn't realize that his father is not the same as our father." And you could see in the picture which brother she was talking about. And for that secret, I felt like I didn't have ownership in a way that it would be right to post it on the web and out that person if he wasn't aware of that.
So you keep some secrets yourself. They don't even get shared with that other community as secrets. You're just the secret keeper.
Well, I think in some ways secrets keep us interesting, and I certainly have personal secrets and project secrets. I'll share one with you. I have one of my secrets in every post-secret book.
And do you want to share one now, or should we just let it out there?
I can share one. In the second post-secret book, it's called My Secret, and that was a book I created for the person who I really was in high school and college when I felt without direction and lonely. And so I included all these secrets that I wished that I had been aware of so I wouldn't have felt alone with some of those difficult emotions at that time in my life. And the postcard I created for that book is made out of a Catcher in the Rye book cover. And the secret says, "If you feel like you're going insane and you're trapped in a dysfunctional environment, you're not crazy." And that's really kind of the message I wish I had heard when I was that age.
So this is something that has obviously changed you over the last 10 years, and now you may give it up. You indicate that you could be ready to pass on the torch to the next person. Can you imagine your life without Post Secret now?
Oh, I certainly feel a strong connection to the project, for sure. And maybe that's one of the reasons I feel like the time is right to either find the right person or to just end the project like I ended the app and preserve its purity. But I do feel like it's time for some kind of transition. The project has been through a lot. We've done a lot with suicide prevention. We've done a lot with post-secret events at college campuses. There's certainly a lot of life left in the project. But at the same time, I don't want it to be a shadow of its former self. I think it's really been special. And even just the stories I heard last night at the post-secret event make me realize that it's continuing to touch people's lives in important ways.
Frank, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
That was Frank Warren, creator of Post Secret. He's the author of several books, including the latest, The World of Post Secret.